Welcome to another edition of Here's an Idea podcast. I'm Sherry Trigg, editor and director of content for Medical Design Briefs. Here's an Idea is a podcast presented by the editors of SAE Media Group that showcases today's most innovative technologies. So patients are more likely to adhere to their treatment plans when drug delivery devices are user-friendly. So what can device developers do to ensure safety, but also provide a positive user experience? Using human factors engineering, developers can design features to prevent errors and contribute to the successful use of a device. Today, I'm talking with Jeff Morang, Director of Human Factors Engineering at Black Hagen Design, a multidisciplinary usability engineering and product design firm that works with startups through Fortune 100 companies. Jeff, thank you for joining me on the podcast today. And can you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, certainly. And Sherry, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk about the wonderful discipline of human factors engineering. Myself, I've been a human factors engineer and a practitioner of human factors engineering for nearly 20 years now in the regulated domains. I started out in aviation. From there, I was working on air traffic control systems. From there, I moved to Department of Defense projects, specifically the Future Combat Systems Program. And then moved on to healthcare, moved back to from California in the San Francisco Bay Area and moved back to Massachusetts in the Boston area and wanted to broaden my horizons and really wanted to help people. And so I ventured into human factors engineering for medical devices. And my career has ranged from point of care devices at Siemens Healthcare Diagnostics, to the consulting realm and working on projects like the Q-Collar, which is currently on being used in the NFL, as well as other professional and amateur sports arenas to prevent head injuries, even neuromodulation devices and surgical assisted robotic systems, which after that, I went into combination drug delivery devices during my tenure at Sanofi. And now here I am back in the consulting realm at Black Hagen Design as Director of Human Factors Engineering. So it's been quite a storied journey.
That is quite a background. So can you go ahead and tell us a little bit about what human factors engineering is, especially for those in our audience who are not familiar with that term? What does it entail?
Certainly. Well, it entails, the short answer is that it entails advocating on behalf of the end users and making sure that products are safe and effective, as well as a joy to use and to interact with. It spans the fields of cognitive, perceptual, and behavioral psychology all the way to the world of the physical world of anthropometrics. That's the body's shape and sizes, because we humans are wonderfully unique and different, and we come in all different shapes and sizes. And also understanding the capabilities of humans and making sure that the device that you are making or the system that you're making is going to support you, the end user, in the intended use environment or use environments. There could be several. And that it is going to be, like I said, a pleasure to use as well as safe and effective. And that's what the FDA and the other regulatory authorities throughout the world care about most, is safe and effective.
Right. Well, it's, speaking of FDA, I understand that FDA has issued a new guidance document, FAQ, on human factors engineering for medtech within the realm of combination products. Mm-hmm. What are the unique needs for those who develop combination products?
Well, really what this is the way I read this latest Q&A document, which is, or guidance, which is titled the Application of Human Factors Engineering Principles for Combination Products, Question and Answers. And it's basically, when I read through this, it is the FDA's response to questions that they have received from submissions that come up frequently, as well as some of the challenges that the FDA sees when they receive these submissions. And they are trying to be responsive and even a little bit more proactive about responding to the needs from industry. From within this guidance, it's within the construct of combination products, like we said, and it's describing what is in Title 21, Part 3 of the Code of Federal Regulations, and and it's also combining good manufacturing practice and requirements for combination products. Where this becomes very important is that the FDA is trying to be more clear about their expectations and really give industry the boost that it needs. Because really the complexity, it comes out of the diverse range that combination drug delivery products bring to the table.
Right.
We really need to be careful and be mindful of the safety and effectiveness of a combination product, because it's being used with a myriad of different users in a myriad of different use environments. It's quite unique in the medical device realm, and that it's carrying a drug on board that is intended to benefit some patient, some user that is going to attempt to incorporate this into their care and therapy regime. So when we're talking about the application of human factors in this realm, we really need to be mindful of and be thoughtful of the considerations that need to be brought to bear for users, considering the fact that if this is intended to be used in the home use environment, that it's intended to be maybe used by a patient or a caregiver, and that patient could have several things, several other medical conditions that contribute to some of their inherent limitations, and those need to be considered. Those limitations could be physical, they could be cognitive, they could be perceptual. And when we're talking about the administration of a drug, and even sometimes of equal importance is the adherence of the drug, then we really need to bring to bear safety, efficacy, and something that is going to want to be used. We don't want it to be difficult to be used. We want it to be pleasant to be used. Really, the overall goal is to, in the human factors process, is to upfront establish who this is going to be for and where are they going to be used, where the intended and anticipated areas and use environments, as well as what do we know about the user. For example, if a user were to have COPD for several years, well, the research bears that this user's likely going to have some level of cognitive decline because of a lack of oxygen that has been delivered to the brain over months or perhaps years, and that needs to be considered.
Well, yeah, the drug delivery process is part of a device, there's certainly all of those things that are different kind of considerations. And so do you find that there are specific factors that a device designer needs to consider for combination products? Are there properties for how the device is stored or the drug's properties that come into consideration?
Yes, of course. Those are all very important considerations. I'll come back to the first. Well, could you remind me what the first part of that question was?
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I was talking about, for combination products, what factors does a device designer need to consider?
Well, coming back to my previous comments that they need to consider the user, and they really need to clearly define what the capabilities and the limitations of that particular user is. Someone that perhaps is experiencing eczema or atopic dermatitis, they could have that on their hands. And that could lead to cracking, very painful cracks in the palms of the hands, or maybe in the fingers. And maybe that would affect holding a device. So you want to consider perhaps the circumference of, if it were an auto injector, for example, you would want to consider the circumference of the device. You wouldn't want to make it too thin. You may want to increase its diameter some to support people with a grip function. You may also want to consider their overall body type and size and other considerations. For example, if we're talking about back to an auto injector example, and the intent is to inject it into your abdomen, well, then, you know, you have to consider that a person might need to see something. They might need to see a progress bar. And if we're talking about a woman with a particularly large bust line, then that might be difficult to see because she can't see through a physical object, which is a part of her body. And so you need to consider then having maybe some redundant feedback, tactile or audible feedback. And then this is where the use environment comes into play, that if it's a use environment that you know could be particularly noisy, if this person could be using it in a public environment, then maybe you want to increase the sound of that audible feedback. Now, what we do here at Black Hagen is we take a proprietary approach to things where we want to consider these things up front, and we want to do research up front, early design research. And many people know this as contextual inquiry. So we want to get out and do this user research as a starting point in our process. And we encourage our clients to do the same. Never have I had a client who went through a process of early contextual inquiry where we get out into the field and it's a show me, don't tell me activity. And the reason why it's a show me, don't tell me activity is because, you know, there are things in the environment that people don't even realize that they do as workarounds, because maybe there's a current device out there that doesn't satisfy and support all of the aspects of their of how to use it and the unique capabilities and limitations that this user has in this particular use environment. And so we try to get out there early, and our clients, when they go through the process, are always 100%. I haven't had one person tell me otherwise, that it's highly informative and they have learned something about the products that they're going to make for these people. And then, you know, we want to make sure that we get those early inputs, and that translates into an understanding, again, of the user, the use environment. But also we start to see some of the design opportunities that exist for making enhancements, or maybe something that didn't even exist in the first place. Maybe there was a workflow that wasn't even understood, and now that's discovered and it needs to be considered in a future design and brought forward. The other part is we get to start identifying these early use-related hazards that exist. So there's quite a bit of benefit that comes out of this process and feeds into a lot of the activities that have to take place when you, the manufacturer, move into design controls. And you have to start documenting things. that becomes vital. So now you are actually ahead of the game. And so many times I've seen that the teams on the manufacturer side want to start designing. It's the fun and exciting thing to do. And again, part of our approach here at Black Hagen is to acknowledge that we need to better understand what path we're going to be on and then start designing, because the quickest way forward is to not have to go back and do it as right as you can the first time. So this becomes a very important process, especially when it comes to drug delivery devices, because you might find that, back to your second part of your question about how it could affect the efficacy of the drug because of the environment, maybe this is in a particularly warm environment, and that warm environment does not have refrigeration. And yet you want people to refrigerate this or keep it in a cool place. There may be a need to better support those users so that they receive the full benefit of the drug.
I was just going to say, so the drug's properties and how it's stored coming into consideration, but because people in, as you kind of just alluded to, I think different regions of the world might have different needs, or even different regions of the United States, for example, correct, would have different needs.
Correct. That is very correct. And we in the United States is an excellent example. We have such a wonderful and vast country, and there are subclimates that are unique to each region of our own country. Southern California and Central California is completely different from Northern Minnesota and Michigan, which is completely different from where I am currently in the Tampa area of Florida, which is highly humid. And in the summer times, frankly, it's like living on the surface of the sun. But the point being that these things may come into play, especially when it comes to using the device and using it, and I'll say device user interface, because it's the whole thing, right? It's the labeling, it's the packaging, it's instructions, it's the device, it's the drug. And everything needs to come together to be one complementary user experience and support the end users. That end user could also be a caregiver, could also be a healthcare professional.
Right. So how does training clinicians and users come into the design and development process?
That's an excellent question. That's a really great question, Sherry. And one that is a delicate topic when it comes to the FDA sometimes. Training is important. I don't want to downplay it. However, the FDA's viewpoint of training is that it is not necessarily considered a part of the device user interface like an instructions might be, unless you, the manufacturer, can make sure that everybody is going to receive that training in the same way. So they're very cautious when it comes to training. And I always advise my clients that be careful with the words that you choose. And it's not necessarily training unless you can guarantee it and everybody's going to receive the same. That's why everybody gets a paper-based instructions for use. Mm-hmm. They call that an IFU. Right. So I'll keep it at IFU for the rest of this conversation. Everyone gets a paper-based IFU currently with their drug combination delivery or drug device combination product. And that is it's commonly considered both a part of the device user interface, but also a part of your risk control measures to guard against improper use or people making mistakes or having difficulties. It also provides information about how to store the device properly and the drug therein. So generally, while training is important, what is more important is how you implement your risk control measures. And you need to consider, back to understanding your users, your use environments, you have to understand that the difference between supporting a healthcare professional in the clinical environment versus maybe a patient or a lay caregiver in the home environment. And we want to ensure that people are going to be incentivized, actually, to pick up instructions. And that, a lot of times, especially for designers, design engineers, they need to do all that they can to encourage people to look at instructions, especially if it's going to be your number one risk control measure. So many times I've seen instructions come and they're in some tightly folded format. As I've shared with my colleagues in the past, that we humans, we eat with our eyes. We look at something and sometimes we make a snap judgment. And that snap judgment has benefited us to survive as a species. Because, you look into the woodline and you need to make a snap judgment of whether that is a tiger or a tree in the tree line. And that snap judgment has sometimes benefit us in terms of survival. But now that is carried forward where you take a look at something and you base what you see on past experiences that you've had, just like that tiger in the woodline or the potential mm-hmm. of a tiger in the woodline. And so what ends up happening is that people may not pick up instructions because they know that what looks like a tightly folded piece of paper is usually going to end up a very large piece of paper with very fine print, and they want to avoid the frustration, so they don't pick that up. So designers should really be mindful and partner with their human factors engineering teammates to really understand how do we get people and encourage them, incentivize them to pick up and interact with that piece of information that we consider so vital. It's a delicate negotiation sometimes with end users to be able to get them to actually interact with your things. And if they're looking at a piece of paper that's tightly folded versus a very elegant piece of equipment, which is the drug delivery device, that sometimes looks more inviting and interesting mm-hmm. than the instructions. And that's where you're going to find all of the safety related information. So, there are two sides to human factors engineering. I think it's important to point that out to everyone that's listening. There's the part that the FDA cares about, and that there's the compliance therein. It is the safety and efficacy and proving that your device user interface is safe and effective to use. And the process to do that is very similar to engineering verification efforts. You break it, you try to break it, and then when you break it, you find out why, and then you fix it. Mm-hmm. That is the same as usability evaluations, and I can get into that in a moment. But then the other side of that is the intuitiveness and the design aesthetics and the quote easy to use features, and the FDA and the medical MDR in Europe and European Medicines Agency. It's not that they don't care about that. Their focus is safety and efficacy. We, as at Black Hagen, we try to straddle that line where we are making safe and effective products, and we bring that to bear and support our clients in proving that within design controls. But then we're also looking at other usability issues when it comes to ease of use and a solid and pleasant user experience that you're going to have when using that device. And that becomes very important from the packaging and the way that looks all the way to the way that the drug makes you feel and the things that are in between. Because if your first look is a box and it's not a pleasant and what looks like a quality experience, then you, the human, are going to wonder, what should I expect from that drug once it's in my body and it's coursing through my veins? So that whole journey, that whole patient journey, is what we attempt to support and enhance and make pleasant, safe, and effective.
And at the same time, you are dealing with human nature to do things like, I want to just start using it right now, or it looks similar to something I already have, so it must be the same. Are those things that you have to combat as well?
That's spot on. You're right, Sherry. That is something that we have to combat. Sometimes you want to slow people down in order to ensure that they are going to use that device as intended. And part of that could be like, please slow down and please read these instructions. If you have even the smallest of doubt of not, or you've never used this before, please read these instructions first, familiarize yourself with this device because it could be different. But on this, along the same vein, we want to support what expectations are. And so that might include conducting human factors engineering, usability engineering evaluations. And that can come in several or a couple of different flavors. One is to conduct an expert review. And that is something that I always encourage my clients to do. It's something that's a little lesser used. However, it still counts as a usability evaluation. Now, there are two silos, if you will, of usability evaluations. There are formative usability evaluations because you're still forming the design. You're still learning things that maybe you didn't know, or you want to verify that maybe a design change or enhancement is working. And then there's the end game, which is the human factors validation, also known as a summative evaluation. And that comes at the end. So I'll focus right now on the beginning. You want to conduct formative evaluations. And the formative evaluations are you as a manufacturer are expected to conduct formative evaluations. Now, as I said before, these formative evaluations are just like engineering verification efforts. You want to test out your design to make sure that it's going to be supportive. Just like engineers would put it on a test rig and they want to test things out and make sure that they're not going to break. That's what we want to do, but from a usability and a support of the human aspect. And an expert review is an excellent way to do it. It's relatively inexpensive and fast. You leverage our training as human factors engineers. We all go to school for this, and we all get degrees for this. And there's a body of knowledge that we can leverage in order to enhance designs based on the literature and the research, and also what are called heuristics, which are rules of the road, guidelines for design. And the international standard, IEC 62366-1, cites an accepted method for applying heuristics to the analysis of a design. And that's by Zhang et al., Z-H-A-N-G. Anybody can download this for free. It's a wonderful article. And you can assess your design based on the tasks that you've designed and the use-related risk analysis that you should do. Now I can come back to that in a moment. But you can evaluate your design and write a report and make design changes. And that counts as one of the formative evaluations that you are going to do. and report back to the FDA as a part of your submission for approval to commercialize your device. But then you can move into maybe later formative evaluations where you are including those intended end users that you've defined at the very beginning of your program. And you are creating a simulated use environment that you maybe there's noise in the background, maybe there's bright lights, maybe there's dim lights. And so you want to simulate that with the intended end users, and you bring in a cohort of these folks, and you ask them to use this all of the tasks or a subset of the tasks, and you want to see, are your risk control measures working? Is the device supporting users in a way that you designed it to be used as mm-hmm. intended? And then if you didn't, then just like an engineering verification, you're going to fix it. And the expectation from the FDA is that you do as many of these as is needed, as you would an engineering verification, until you can prove and feel confident proving that the device can be used safely and effectively. Now, I mentioned use-related risk. Yes. The expectation that here's one of the number one reasons, one of the top reasons for the FDA requesting additional information or of a manufacturer or mm-hmm. turning away a manufacturer from an approval for commercialization is the fact that they haven't gone through the activity of outlining the intended use tasks. This would be called a task analysis. So just like in a recipe, list out all of the tasks, list out all of the steps that you have to complete to as related to that task, and mm-hmm. identify, do these need to be performed sequentially? Can they be performed concurrently or in any order? Who is performing this task? And then identify all of the use-related hazards, also called use errors, never mm-hmm. a user error, always right. a use error. We never blame the human. We always blame the device. And so this use error, what are the risks and what are the reasons for it? And then categorically, what are your risk control measures that you have put in place? For example, recently a client has an infusion pump, and there was a step where they need to prime the tubing that is associated with this infusion pump. And there's a set amount, it was somewhere around 10 microliters. And so my question was, are you intending that the user tell the infusion pump when to stop? And they said, well, yes, that's the intent. And I said, okay, what is your risk? What risk control measure do you have in place? And the answer was, well, we're going to stop at 13 microliters. That is a risk control measure. It's not mm-hmm. a user requirement, and it's not the intended use, but it's a risk control measure that's in place to make sure that they don't dispel too much of the drug in the infusion pump. So you need to categorically go through that. And then when you get to your formative usability evaluations in the end, then you want to try those out. You want to test them to see if it's working for people. Maybe they forgot to hit that button on the infusion pump to stop it. But then you see that, sure enough, the infusion pump stops. That means that your risk control measure is working. You're supporting the user. They didn't have to remember that. And that, right. if you go to the heuristics, that's one of the heuristics, is to minimize the memory load. So you want to support the user. They shouldn't have to hold these things in long-term or working memory and pull it from long-term memory and bring it forward to this moment to apply to using this device. Because the truth is, a lot of these users that are out there in the world of healthcare, mm-hmm. especially healthcare professionals, sometimes they are using 25 different devices in a day. It's just a tool in their toolbox. Or maybe we're talking about a grandparent or a loved one, an aunt or an uncle, that uses that auto injector maybe once every 2 months, and they're older, and the truth is that they don't remember everything. So we want to help them out. We want to give them the support that they need.
Absolutely. So I'm going to just kind of go back a little bit because I want to make sure we understand, is the human factors engineering process different at all for developing these combination devices than it is for developing a standard device that has no drug component?
It certainly can be. It certainly can be. And it's a great question. It really sometimes depends on your regulatory approach. So you're going to be in clinical studies with a combination drug delivery device. And part of your usability engineering, human factors engineering plan might be to develop prototypes of the device that get you into the clinical, maybe a phase two or phase three clinical trial or clinical study. And you need to support those users. So you want to have maybe two arms or two stages to your human factors engineering process that get you into a clinical study and get you the data that you need to prove that your drug molecule is effective. That could also include training. And so you many times I advise my clients or our clients to consider doing formative evaluations that get you into your clinical study and maybe even a preclinical human factors validation study or preclinical summative study evaluation. And you want to make sure that maybe these instructions that are intended for clinical study staff are supportive, not confusing, that are not going to lead to use errors or use difficulties that could affect your data. Because the truth is that a lot of these companies are spending millions of dollars on clinical studies. You also are probably going to do some training. And so the training of the clinical study staff, you want to also make sure that it's supportive and not acting as an interferent that is going to lead to erroneous data. And you may want to maybe switch your device user interface in the middle of one of your clinical studies and file an extension. And maybe you're going to swap from your clinical device user interface to your intended commercial device user interface. And you are going to want to gather some data about the how effective, safe and effective that device is going to be when in the hands of the clinical study staff and while patients are in the care of the clinical study staff. And then there's also another version, and sometimes an even trickier version, and that is an actual use human factors validation. So now you are in the middle of maybe a clinical study, or the best way that you can validate your device user interface as safe and effective is to have users actually use the device instead of maybe something that is maybe has a placebo on board your device, your combination drug delivery device, or a drug mimic that is mimicking mimicking the drug viscosity so that you can't tell the difference, though it actually is the simulated use of this product. And in that event, the FDA has been crystal clear that if that is your intent, to please, as early as possible, reach out to the FDA and present them with how you're going to conduct an actual use study and partner with them. so that they can weigh in and even help you develop the protocol to get through an actual use study. These are rare events. The actual use studies do not happen very often, but the FDA acknowledges that sometimes, and I think professionally it's quite mature of the FDA and supportive on our side to help us out, to even be a bit of a consultant themselves, so that you're bringing them along for the ride and they can help you out.
And certainly eliminate some of the questions at the end of the process and having to go back and do anything over too.
Correct. Because ultimately the FDA, I recently had a conversation with some FDA representatives, and they were quick to point out and remind me that the FDA has three main purposes. It is to get drugs and devices to a point of safety, safe and effective. That's number two. But also first in Americans so they want to partner with us. They want to partner with us on the device design and the manufacturing side. They want to be helpful to all of us. And it's been my experience that they've many times they've been great. It's a little bit different drug delivery combination device side, or in that DMEPA and they haven't necessarily been. I think they're a bit overwhelmed because there's quite a number of requests, so they have limited the amount of interactions, unlike CDRH of late. So you have to incorporate that into your planning activities and your regulatory strategy.
Well, that's a really a great insight for you to share. I really appreciate you bringing that up. And I would like to also say we've talked a lot about the process, and I wanted to make sure that if we haven't covered anything that's important, that if you'd like to add at this point, because I think this is going to be extremely valuable information for our readers or our listeners, excuse me.
No problem. I would like to stress to anyone that and everyone that is listening to start this process of identifying your tasks as early, the intended use tasks as early as possible, and your use-related risk analysis, your URRA, use-related risk analysis process, also as early as possible. And if you can do it before you start actually designing things, so that you can accelerate your process, it has huge benefit, not just from a regulatory standpoint and not just as you transition into design controls and you start kicking off your risk management activities. It's also your number one alignment tool for your team. Number one, whenever you have people coming on to the program and they are going to ask, so what are we doing? And your response is going to be, I want you to go read the use specification that identifies our users and our use environments in detail. And then I want you to read the task analysis, and the use-related risk analysis, because then you're going to see all our happy path, how we intend people to use this. And you're going to see all of the things that we've identified that might go wrong and how we're going to control against that. And now your team has a very clear understanding of what it is they're doing and why. And you're going to need that information anyway to give to the FDA. How are the FDAs are humans too. And how are they going to know how your device user interface is supposed to be used unless you tell them? And how are they going to know that you've identified all of the risks? And how do they know that you've actually controlled for those risks if you don't outline it categorically? very organized and in very clear way. So those two efforts alone and how human factors can not only help with regards to making devices that are safe and effective, but we're also helping out with your process, and we're also helping out with keeping your team aligned and pulling in the same direction, and we're also helping you accelerate your timeline. So please call us. If not Black Hagen, there are plenty of other wonderful design consultancies out there that also do a wonderful job. I hope that it's Black Hagen, but again, I trust all of my contemporaries out there in the field. They're doing great work. And yeah, that's the message I would like to really drive home with everyone.
That's fantastic. Jeff, thank you for joining us for the podcast and for sharing your expertise in human factors with our listeners. If you would like to learn more about human factors engineering, please reach out to Jeff Morang at Black Hagen Design.
Yes, thank you. Sherry, it's been a pleasure. And I look forward to the next time that we're able to talk about this. Thank you.
Thank you. If you'd like to provide feedback on this episode or suggest future guests, please email me at sherry.trigg@saemediagroup.com. You can listen to this podcast at medicaldesignbriefs.com/podcasts or on your favorite podcast app such as Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Thank you for listening, and watch for more coverage of exciting new technologies on Here's an Idea.